Hey, this is Evan Phillips from Anchorage, Alaska. You're listening to The Fern Line. Alaska, the highest concentration of big, remote mountains in North America. For generations, a unique group of climbers have tested themselves in these vast alpine arenas. The Chugach, St. Elias, the Hays, Neocola, the Kachatnas, the Revelations. Their stories are etched on high alpine walls. Their visions follow lines of cold gray ice. What inspires them? What makes them come back? Who survives? Who suffers? These are the stories we'll tell on Season 1 of The Fern Line. Hey friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 1, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of what's possible in Alaska's mountains. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with extraordinary people, folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in one of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. Well, before we get started today, I just wanted to thank everyone who's been listening to the show. I've been getting a lot of reviews on iTunes, which is great. And I've been getting a bunch of emails from people too. And one of those emails I would like to share with you today. This email is from Megan Helton, and she sent me this a couple weeks ago. And here's the email. Evan, today I was shoveling mulch at work, listening to your podcast. Happy that warm temps and sunshine is here to stay in Montana, when I heard your shout out to my boyfriend, Bob Goodwin. What a surprise and what a smile it generated. Thank you. Bob was so excited when he found your podcast. We listened to the first episode twice in a week during an adventure we dubbed the Montana Rock and Ice Tour Spring Break Edition. We listened to subsequent episodes while making breakfast or on late night drives. I'm so happy he's up there. Bob left for Alaska, and I took off to the desert with a couple friends for a week. I missed his last call out before leaving Talkeetna, as it was a day early, and I was up Castle Valley, scraping knees and elbows on sandstone. As romantic as a voicemail with a plane in the background may be, a 30-day radio silence can be hard. So, I've re-listened to all your episodes, keeping my excitement for him high and the missing him in perspective. To hear his name felt like some cosmic tie that he'd tease me about feeling. I wanted to thank you for your work in building a community and for helping me stay connected to a very special man. Maybe I'll join Bob one year and we can buy you a beer or two. Cheers. Yeah, so that was a special email to get. Thanks for sending that, Megan. And I just want to encourage everybody that's listening to feel free to reach out. I love getting your emails. All right, so with that, it's time to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch or camp chair and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line. Nestled in the heart of the Alaska Range lies what many consider to be one of the most beautiful mountains anywhere in the world, Mount Huntington. Rising on all sides to form a symmetrical pyramid of rock, snow, and ice, Huntington has captured the imagination of bold and dedicated alpinists for decades. When the French Ridge was first climbed in 1964, the mountaineering world took notice. Then, just a year later, when David Roberts and crew climbed the stunning West Face, the mountaineering world was shocked. Both of these climbs raised the standard of what could be done in Alaska's mountains, as well as setting a precedent for what future alpinists could expect on Huntington: remoteness, sustained hard climbing, the risk of total commitment. By 2016, most of Huntington's major features had been climbed, but one line, perhaps the most committing of them all, had yet to be ascended: the complete South Ridge. Rising nearly 7,000 feet, the South Ridge follows a serpentine spine of four jagged subpeaks, each connected by delicate gendarmes and stacked cornices. Although a few teams had ascended the upper South Ridge of Huntington over the years, few parties had considered a go at the complete South Ridge. That is, until this year. Over a stretch of perfect weather in April 2017, American alpinists Jess Roskelly and Clint Helander made the first ascent of the complete South Ridge in a single 5-day push. The climb was everything the duo had anticipated and more, pushing the limits of their endurance and forcing them to commit psychologically in a way neither of them had experienced in the past. A few days later, after they got down from the climb, I sat down with Jess and Clint in Anchorage to recount this once-in-a-lifetime adventure. The interview picks up on the second day of their trip as they are crossing the East Fork of the Tokositna Glacier and starting their initial climb up the South Ridge.
It was scorching hot as soon as we got in the sun, and we took off our long johns and we were just hiking in our soft shells and took off all of our R1 hoodies and everything, and we're in t-shirts and we're still just hot, sweating.
Our packs got heavier.
The packs kept getting heavier because we kept taking off clothing, and I didn't have gloves on. And if there'd been any more snow on that south face of that first peak, I would have been greatly concerned, but it was just hard and firm and pretty bone dry. And so we felt really good about climbing on it because we weren't worried about a loaded face that was going to avalanche on us. So we spent the whole entire day just sweating and humping our way up this face, putting in pro when needed, but simul-climbing the entire thing.
So is this the face that gets you on to the South Ridge of Huntington?
Yeah, this is the south face of peak 9460.
Which is that the first tower?
That's the first tower. And we start from, you start climbing at 5,700. So you gain just shy of 4,000 feet to get to that first thing. And that is the biggest physical day. So I kind of started thinking of this whole ridge as a gauntlet, running the gauntlet. And the first day I said to Jess, well, this is probably the physical gauntlet because we have to do the biggest vertical day. And who knows what other gauntlets we're going to have to run in days to come.
Yeah.
So at about 10:30, after the sun had set, but the late April twilight was still lingering, we finally found a really nice spot to chop out a ledge and put our tent up and just tried to take care of ourselves because we knew that before long we were going to have to be on the way.
So how are you feeling, Jess? And what was going through your mind that first night at the bivvy?
Well, I knew that kind of the point of no return. I mean, I didn't want to go back up the crevasse field, but it would have been fine. I knew the point of no return was going to be that following day, going over the first kind of the gunsight notch on the first peak. And, but to be honest with you, I mean, once I get into camp, I don't really think about anything. I was thinking about food, hydrating. It was just so hot and, relaxing. And I don't think there wasn't 10 minutes where we didn't laugh about something the whole time. So, you know, we were quite entertained. And, once I get into camp, I just relax and not think about that next day too much.
Cool. That sounds like a good skill to have in the mountains for getting rest at night.
Yeah. Once I fall asleep, no one's going to wake me up. That's about all there is to it.
Okay. Well, maybe walk me through that next morning and getting into that, I guess, the second proper day of climbing on Huntington.
Got up and we headed on up to the top of the first peak. And this was kind of one of the cruxes that, that Clint had, had previously talked to me about. And we, and what it was just a wrap off, you know, like a full wrap down. And I didn't know if it was going to be a big deal or not, but as it turns out is, we put in a couple anchors and wrapped off. And as I was wrapping down, that lower peak had some real loose, nasty rock. And, as I got down into the notch, it was hard for me to find some gear and whatnot. And I did find some, but I was pretty much right there in the path of a rock coming down or something like that. So I kind of was yelling up, you know, hey, be careful, cause I'm right here. And, you know, he came on down and we both looked at each other and thought, well, we don't want to go back up that way either. So let's keep going. Let's get a move on. It was always a sense of, you know, we were relaxed, but there was also always a sense of urgency to keep going.
Cool. Clint, just take it from there. Talk about, what was the climbing like? What were the conditions like? Just talk about the experience.
The majority of the South Ridge is composed of really high quality granite, but this first notch there contained one of two intrusions on the ridge of really poor black fractured rock that didn't take pro. It seemed to be undercut, so it was always overhanging and forced us to make another rappel and traverse below it because we couldn't really climb on it and it didn't take pro. And so below this bad rock was wild flutings of snow and ice. And we ended up doing these wild traverses and we'd climb up and then we'd have to rappel and then traverse and down climb and climb back up again. So you gain all this elevation and then you lose it and you gain it and you lose it. And it was very tedious and we ended up doing these really long simul pitches when we could, but sometimes we were forced to do these really short pitches just to get around one overhanging gendarme. And in the late evening, we'd made pretty good progress, but it had sure taken a lot of time. And we were both pretty wet from this kind of wet storm that had come in. And we finally got beyond the little gun sight bad rock portion and we're nearing the second peak. And so I think at this point I was leading one of my blocks and I got up onto the snow arete and chopped through the cornice and there was just this wild, really tall overhanging cornice and I had to climb up it and then climb down it. And trying to think of my partner, I put in this picket and then just traversed on the ridge as far as I could until I found a belay. And of course, as soon as I pulled the damn rope tight, the picket ripped out and was just hanging in the air like a keychain. And so Jess comes over and I look at him. I go, I tried, man. I'm really sorry. And he's just like, oh, fuck. It has to down climb this thing. And now it's, you know, 10 o'clock and we're cold, tired, and kind of on day three at this point from base camp. So we're looking for a bivvy because we have to get some sleep and do it for another couple days. And I brought Jess in and we did one more pitch and found this really perfect ridge that contained a surprise that we never would have guessed.
1/2 ounce of weed?
Well, I don't really smoke weed, so that wouldn't have done me any good.
What'd you find?
Well, 2 days before leaving on this ridge, after years of researching, I found a single sentence from the 1979 American Alpine Journal, Angus Thurmer, who had put up a route on Huntington, had said that 13 Japanese had tried the complete South Ridge from the base, and they had bailed after a month at the top of the second tower. And so I kind of thought, well, maybe we'll find some gear that they had left there, pitons or something along the way that will help us. And we didn't find shit, not a single thing. And so I kind of started to doubt it because, you know, in the 1970s, expedition style, people brought a lot of stuff and they tended to leave a lot behind. And we didn't find anything. But as I pulled up onto this bivvy, I looked over and I saw this picket with an old white rope. And then I looked over to my left and I saw two pins with this thing of ice cresting all over it. And I realized it was this massive cache from the 1979 Japanese Sapporo team. And so I screamed down to Jess that I have a surprise. And he arrives and we chopped it out and we found all this stuff, including about 35 pitons, which helped us immensely.
Oh, wow.
We had plenty of pitons, but now we could just use these other pitons at our disposal. And man, did they help.
Cool. That's awesome. So at the second night where this the Japanese cache was, that was from the 70s?
79.
Yeah. We camped at the exact ledge for sure that they had used because it was certainly the best flat spot for quite a while in either direction.
And this is on top of the second tower?
This is near the top of the second tower, yeah. We still had another 400 feet to climb to the summit of that tower.
Okay. So Jess, maybe talk about the climb from that point on.
I was excited to see those pitons too. I think we were both, it was funny, I noticed we were supposed to be chopping the ledge, but I noticed that both of us were kind of chopping out the pitons at the same time just to see what else is in there. So the ledge took a little longer than usual, but it's like, you know, buried treasure or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, the next morning it was a good moderate, you know, climb up to the top of the second peak. It was no problem. Clint led the way kind of all along the way to the top. I mean, I seem to remember seeing a bunch of different, pitons and things that did, you know, obviously show that those guys were up there on that second peak. We never saw anything on the first peak, but the second peak, there was some evidence of that. And then as I pulled over the top, Clint kept going on this block. And that's kind of where, after the second peak, he kind of went down. And I thought, holy shit. And he kind of kept going. Clint's a really excellent snow climber. And you know, I love ice, and I can do it all day long. And I love rock climbing. And but Clint's good at all that as well. But damn, you know, really steep, nasty snow is a real talent to climb, and he's really good at it. And I kind of really figured that out at this point. Really steep traversing, kind of going around all these corners, and it was kind of the start of the real traversing, the difficulties in that way.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting because it seems like on these Alaskan ridges, you know, where it's like just weird conditions, steep, just nasty snow. It seems like it's like you almost have to wonder, is like, well, what's scarier, leading it or following it? It sounds like you had to follow it, which, you know, maybe it was pretty freaky.
Well, at some points I didn't want to do either, but, but I was, stuck with one or the other. Certainly, following it is fairly awful. Clint was really good with putting in a lot of pro to where I would have been safe most of the time. And but leading it was extremely heady as well. So yeah.
It's really funny to be called a good snow climber. It's something I didn't really think about, I guess, until being on this climb. It's like somebody saying you're really good at riding saucers or something, but I guess when you think about snow climbing, you think about, oh, just putting your foot in and stepping. But man, it's like this weird flotation thing, almost like you're climbing jelly or something. You just kind of will put your shoulders in and weight your hands and then your knees and kind of rock up on it. And you'll sink in and you'll climb 2 feet and gain 6 inches. And then you do it again. And yeah, I don't know if it's an art, but maybe it's something that I've had
real pain in the ass.
It's a real pain in the ass, but I've had the fortune or misfortune of, I guess, climbing a lot of it. So yeah, it was just a lot of this traversing, again, doing the whole traversing, climb up, and then you have to do a rappel, and then you traverse, and you climb up, and you down climb. So, you know, on this ridge, you look at it on the topo and you think, oh, it's going to be a 6,000, 7,000 foot ridge, but you end up climbing 500 feet and you're right back to where you started. Yeah. And so, yeah, at the end of this really long day, this was the technical gauntlet day. The day before had been the emotional gauntlet, and the first day had been the physical gauntlet. At the end of it, we arrived at the base of the third tower and found this overhanging cornice connecting the ridge right at a pretty good band of rock, and we bivvied on that cornice, again, able to barely set up our tent, but slept tied in, wondering how much of us was hanging over the edge.
We had to Rochambeau for who's going to be on the cornice side. I think I lost that night. Yeah. That night I lost.
Okay. Yeah. Let's keep going. Let's take it from there. So you're at the bivvy. Maybe Jess, talk about the next day's climbing up towards the top of that third tower.
First of all, yeah, I was about asleep, and Clint kind of, said, "Hey, get out here and look at this." I thought, oh God, okay, what is it? And it's probably the most beautiful Northern Lights show I've ever seen. And I used to work up on the oil pipeline up here in Prudhoe, and I've seen it before, but that one was just this bright green streak of lights kind of going through the mountains. And it was really incredible. He went outside, and after all that effort all day, he was out there taking pictures still and captured some really good photos of that. And then, like most nights, I fell asleep right away, and I think we woke up a little bit later. I think we went pretty late that night, and we must have woke up at about 9. I think we were, and the whole time I thought, oh gosh, I got this, the condensation in the tent throughout this trip was really getting my bag wet. And I thought, oh God, I wonder if this thing's, hopefully I can dry this thing out later. Who knows what we're going to, how cold it's going to get or what we're going to get into. But fortunately, it wasn't too bad the next morning. And we took off on the way up the next peak, which it started off with some pretty good rock climbing, didn't it?
Yeah, we started off on this long simul block, and man, probably 800 feet of simul climbing, and in that we started having some pretty excellent mixed climbing. Really, truly high quality granite. And I'm in there climbing with this heavy pack on, thinking, my God, I'm doing some pretty cruxy climbing, and even doing some aid moves, pulling on cams and stuff with 200 feet of rope out. And God knows if there's 50 feet of slack somewhere in that rope, but I just knew I wasn't going to fall, and kind of took the time to make sure my gear was good and not get too stupid. And I pulled up onto this really narrow cleft at the top of this chimney at the base of this soaring, beautiful crack that I knew Jess was going to lead, because I was really psyched, because I'd just done this long block and I was excited for him. And right at that time, Paul Roderick of TAT flew over, and he was just soaring over the ridge, and I knew he was looking for us and keeping tabs on us. And that was one of those really comforting moments, to know that we had this guy that, even if he couldn't land and help us, he was keeping an eye on us and he was excited, and there was somebody out there watching out for us. Yeah. That was really cool. Yeah, we brought Jess up, and before long he was taking off on this beautiful pitch, of which I was incredibly envious.
I grabbed some of the gear, and there was just a perfect hold, a pick hold, kind of a little bit above your, quite a bit above your head. But once you got that, it was this perfect hand crack, and I took my gloves off and, racked them where I usually rack my eye screws, and actually just was looking forward to getting on it. Had a great time and kept on going. And, then it kind of eased off for a little while, a little more rock. And then we ended up.
So at this point in time, are we on the top of the third tower?
Yes. And then we rappelled off the third tower, and it's not just as simple as doing a rappel. you're doing these rappels where the leader is having to put in these redirectional pieces and then do these traversing rappels. So you're almost like rappelling and climbing to get as far away as you can or get to the next rock where you can set up a belay and then traverse again. And after rappelling off the third peak, we're now at the base of Idiot Peak, which is 10,700 feet on the summit. And it's getting late again, so now we're going through the whole shenanigans of trying to find a bivvy. And I thought there was just going to be great spots all over, and as usual, I was pretty wrong.
Oh, that's right.
And so now, with the last of our light, Jess takes the lead, and we're trying to find something, and he climbs up 200 feet to this thing we'd spotted that was going to be the bivvy of all bivvies, and it ends up just being this ice ridge where there's no way we can bivvy there. And ultimately, he found this pretty decent spot, not the dream tent bivvy, but it worked, and we ended up sleeping like babies.
Cool. So maybe just take it from there, Jess. Like, this is 3 full days of climbing now on the ridge. Four. How are you feeling at this point in time?
I think physically we've both felt great. I think we were tired, but I think we were really excited and we're still pumped about the entire thing. And, we would talk and we're like, oh, we're going to the top. We do not want to go back the way we came. So, we were still really psyched about that. We found this little bowl kind of under a rock, and right when it was getting dark, and this is the one night we did not set up the tent. We kind of slept out in the open, and I slept great. My bag dried out, and it was a beautiful night. And
fully tied in.
Yeah.
Fully hammock style. We had slings around our feet and slings cinched up around our shoulder to keep us in because there was this great precipice below us. And,
wow.
But it was beautiful, and was that the night that we had the Northern Lights again?
Yeah.
So when I go to bed in the mountains, I usually work myself to where I just, like I said before, I just out, which is a real talent of mine. And a lot of times I'll talk to you if you talk to me, but the lights might seem on, but nobody's home. So the Clint, I guess, was, hey, check out the Northern Lights. And I think I said, I'm in bed. Not waking up, and kind of made him laugh, I think. Yeah. But the next day, we woke up and went at it again. And I remember looking down from the second peak, and now we were kind of, what was it, midway up the third peak?
We're going up Idiot Peak.
Or up Idiot Peak, yeah. And I remember looking down and thinking, holy cow, like, that looks pretty hard. It looks pretty tough from here. But going up Idiot Peak, it ended up being really good climbing, awesome climbing. And actually, just a few minutes after we started climbing that next day, we walked by this cave. I thought, oh, shit. We had just gone.
Dream bivvy.
Yeah.
It was perfect, man. It was like this big cave with a nice flat spot in it. And I was like, damn it.
Yeah.
But that's the way it goes.
Cool. So, Clint, maybe talk about that day climbing up Idiot Peak. So Idiot Peak is essentially the last sub-peak before the final push-up Huntington, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, Idiot Peak is the last major tower before you actually get on the body of Huntington, whatever you want to refer to it as. And I think we both knew that as long as we could rappel off Idiot Peak, and at this point we really didn't have a choice. Once we rappelled off Idiot Peak, we both knew we were going to get to the summit because we could look ahead and see that the climbing wasn't as difficult as what we had come across. And as we did this big traverse on the summit of Idiot Peak on these massive cornices, huge, that just lean over like 30 feet over the face, like these outstretched claws. We were on snow and the occasional ice screw, and then just belayed right at the right spot where we had to wrap down to hit the coal. And we were going to do one of those snowbag anchors or something, and it was going to be really terrifying. And I just said, well, let me look over here and see what I can see. And I peered over on belay over the cornice and just found perfect ancient blue ice. And 5 minutes later, we had a great V-thread, and three full rappels brought us down to the coal. And at this point, I think we both started feeling the fatigue pretty well. The weather that had held strong for weeks and weeks, right as predicted, was breaking down. But now we're 4 hours from the summit of Huntington. And we both agreed that we needed to break to not only drink some water and eat some food, but to take our boots off, because our feet were starting to really hurt and we were definitely breaking down physically. So we took a 30-minute break, and we're just watching the clouds raise up and the clouds above us fall down. So we didn't really waste much time. And again, we did a couple of these weird rappels and ended up breaking out on this really fractured rock, about the worst rock of the entire trip. And come around this corner, there's this massive serac hanging above us, but I kind of lied to myself and said it didn't look like it was going to go, and looked like it hadn't gone for a while. And it was the easiest route, so we kind of climbed sort of under that. And yeah, I just did a big long block, and then I was pretty gassed by that point in time, but now we're less than 1,000 feet from the summit of Huntington. And I just said, all right, Jess, can you take us to the top? And in a fury of swings and kicks and dull crampons and butter knife front points and stuff, he hacked through some pretty hard ice, hard in terms of compression, and got some screws in and took us up.
Yeah, Jess, maybe just talk about that last block of climbing up towards the top.
Well, like Clint said, we were both exhausted at this time. I think we were mentally and physically just hammered. And he's right. My crampons and my tools, I might as well have been swinging to the ice with pool noodles, you know, float noodles or something. I don't know. It was pretty ridiculous. So I tried to find ice on the way up that had a little snow covering on it or something, you know, but it was just bulletproof Alaskan ice up high. And, you know, at this point, I got right up to the summit ridge there. And at this point it was starting to get fairly nasty. The visibility was really low. I wasn't really sure where I went. So I brought, you know, after four pitches of simul climbing, I brought Clint up, and cause he had been to the summit before, and let him take over from there. I didn't want to lead us into something I didn't know where I was going.
Yeah. Yeah, just take it from there, Clint.
I went up there on easy walking and got to the summit, sat down, kicked a little hole, and brought him up on a just hand belay and a view of absolutely nothing in this cloud. And on something like this, I couldn't really allow myself to even celebrate, because the gravity of getting down is still so high, and there's still so many ways to mess up. And the job at this point was just remaining safe and getting down. But quickly, we both were pretty cold and tired. So we dropped about 150 feet off the summit to the summit ridge, and both just agreed that the best thing we could do would be to set up our tent, because we had gas. We didn't really have much food, but we had days and days of gas. And
good.
And staying safe was the number one goal. So yeah, we ended up sleeping on the summit that night. And in the morning, we packed up our stuff and tried to go down, and we got right to the top of the rappels, but we couldn't see anything. And given the fact that we had gas and communication via InReach, and Jess's cell phone worked, so he was able to call his family and just let everybody know that, hey, we're totally safe. We're making the right call by staying here. And the weather is supposed to break at some point in time. And when it does, we will descend. And we stayed there for another full day in the sun, or not really the sun, but just letting our bags kind of dry out and really just resting and getting ready for what could be a pretty big descent.
And we slept for 6 hours or something.
I think we were more tired than we thought we were or allowed ourselves to be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to me because whenever I got to the top of something, you know, it's like you have that feeling of being like, oh, man, I'm so psyched we did it. But then there's always like that looming kind of presence of, well, I've got to get down. And it's easy when you really just want to get down from something to maybe cut a corner. And it sounds like you guys didn't cut corners on making really smart decisions. Jess, can you maybe like talk about that process?
Yeah, I mean, right away, I think it was a mental thing because I felt tired, but okay. But the second I hit the summit, I was like, I mean, I was dragging my knuckles on the ground, and you know, that first and second night that we slept up there. I mean, the second night we buried a picket and we were gonna rappel off, but we both kind of simultaneously thought to ourselves, hey, wait a minute, let's stop. You know, we had lots of fuel. We had a couple snacks. We had some bouillon, poor man's soup for dinner that night. And, but we were fine. And it was better than rushing it and going down and making a mistake. I mean, the weather wasn't so bad that, you know, we were going to freeze to death or anything up there. It was just a smart decision to sit there and relax and make sure that we descend carefully. Because that's where you're going to make a mistake.
Yeah. So when you woke up from the second bivvy, I guess this would have been like your sixth or seventh day on the mountain.
Seventh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think.
How did you feel like when you woke up from that second bivvy, and maybe talk about just what happened?
I still felt like shit. And I was still pretty exhausted. You know, we hopped out of the tent and wasn't too bad of weather, but it certainly wasn't great. And the thing I noticed about me was that my fingers and my toes were really cold, and I knew that it's going to be good to go down and get down lower and warm myself up. I think my body was just tired at that point. And, you know, I had seen the descent from where we had landed and whatnot, but Clinton had done it before. And I was really thankful for that because it was sort of hard to find. I thought, especially in those conditions, and Clint kind of took over and kind of led the rappels from there, which was great. And it was really helpful, and it kind of saved my ass for sure.
Cool. Clint, you want to just maybe give your perspective of that last day getting down?
Well, I had really truly hoped that the teams before us there would have been V-threads and stuff on the way down. So now you're just rappelling, finding the V-thread, pulling the rope, putting in a backup, bing, bam, boom. But that wasn't really the case. And so we ended up putting in our own V-threads, which is fine, but it just took an extra 8 or 10 minutes on every rappel. But I had really feared that it was going to take 8, 9, 16 hours in this horrible weather, one stuck rope, and all of a sudden you're totally messed up for 5 hours and pulling all this crazy shenanigans to unstick this rope. But everything just went as flawlessly as it possibly could have, thank God. And every once in a while, we would find the rappel anchors that were fixed in the rock. And I knew we were totally on the right track. And before long, I saw the West Face Cooler. And I knew all we had to do was make about 9 or 10 more rappels. And we would cross the Schrun, and then we could celebrate. And so that went pretty smooth. And I think we were 4.5 hours, maybe, at the most. But that time we had spent up there, as crazy as it sounds, really, really helped us to recover enough to have the mental clarity to get down safely. And I'll never regret that decision.
Yeah. I don't think that people, you know, that maybe haven't done a lot of hard alpine climbing, it's like there's an experience, you know, that it's not like going out and climbing a handful of pitches of ice off the road or going and, you know, climbing 15 pitches of rock in Red Rocks. It's a totally different game. And Clint, how did you feel the moment you crossed the Bergschrund coming off the West Face?
I felt tremendous relief, for one, that we were safe. And certainly that feeling of accomplishment started to sink in. But I think even more than that, I felt a certain amount of pride in my own maturity that I had seen develop as a climber. Because this is something that, even if I'd been as strong when I was in my early 20s, you can't quickly get that knowledge base that you get from a decade and a half of climbing in the mountains and all these things. And so I was proud that I had really done the work. I felt like I had prepared for it. And I was never a great student in school, but I felt like I had aced this exam, A+. And that was something that brought me great pride, because not only was it just a beautiful line, but I felt that Jess and I couldn't have done it in any better style. And I felt that the whole time we made really good decisions. And so more than the pride of having done something of that magnitude, I was really, really proud of the decisions we'd made and the style and how great we got along for the entire trip.
Yeah. What about you, Jess? How did you feel once you guys got, you know, past the Schrund? And I mean, you're pretty much home free off this thing.
Well, excellent. I was headed straight for the tent. I had some licorice there and all sorts of goodies, and that was about the first thing I had on my mind. But the other part of it is that, I mean, let's get one thing straight. I mean, without the work that Clint put into this, I mean, there's no way. There's no way. He knew where we were and what we were doing, and he knew everything about it. And it was, and I knew that he had done a lot of homework on it. And he has a journal, and he had written a year beforehand about this climb. And it was really inspiring to see that, you know, he picked a goal and we saw it through. And I was just really happy to be a part of it and really lucky that he gave me a call. And it was a real, real pleasure.
Yeah. Maybe while we're talking about that too, I mean, you know, it's interesting because like it seems like really the core theme of the Fernline podcast has really turned into talking about the relationships in the mountains and talking about like the partnerships forged. And what does it mean for you to have like a partner like Clint?
Really good. I mean, you know, for years now, I've been climbing with a guy named Ben Erdman. He's an excellent climber and a very, very close friend of mine. And but we also climb with other guys. And I think it's important not to get too used to the same partner all the time. I think Mark Westman kind of it's beneficial to kind of go separate ways sometimes and climb with different people. You learn things and create new relationships. And you know, I knew Clint was a good climber, and I knew, you know, and I knew he was a good guy, and I knew we had this great sense of, you know, the same sense of humor. And so, I figured it was going to go very well, and it did. And there wasn't one thing that didn't go well. I pride myself in being a guy that is fairly easy to get along with. I like, you know, I like all sorts of different people. So doesn't really matter, but you know, what kind of things they have going on. I usually have a great time. But with Clint, we really do have the same sense of humor. We crack jokes all the time, and it was pretty amazing. So not only did we on-site this really great route, we on-sited the partnership, which was just as great.
Clint, can you talk about what's your perspective on the partnership and what was good about it for you?
Yeah, exactly what Jess mentioned, just being able to laugh with somebody and know that you're kind of thinking the same things or you're along the same lines when you're in these difficult situations. That's really important. And I never felt like we had to convince each other of something. And this, it just flowed naturally for us, I felt like, on this entire climb. As far as where it's going to go in the future, I don't really know, because I don't think we'll ever climb anything like the complete South Ridge of Huntington again together, but I'm sure it won't be the last time that we're up there feeling pretty committed together.
So Jess, what's next for you? What's next for you in your life after this climb?
I'm looking forward to going home and spending time with my wife and the dogs, and we have a big project in Spokane. I'm starting in partnership with the Front Climbing Club. We're starting a climbing gym in Spokane, and hopefully that goes through 20,000 square feet of climbing.
And cool.
So that's a big project that I'm going to be working on. And I'm a welder, and I love to weld and TIG weld and just get a little work done, do some rock climbing, and get ready for the next big adventure.
Cool. I didn't even really think to ask about it, but when I was a young climber, you know, I read all of your dad's books. He was a huge inspiration to my climbing. I don't know if you can answer this for your dad, but like, how does he see what you're doing right now? And what's that relationship like for you with your dad?
Well, it was funny because my dad was at the house when Clint sent me a bunch of pictures of this ridge. And I said, "Hey, what do you think of this?" He goes, "Ugh, it looks dangerous."
Yeah.
And I thought, I'll be fine. So, you know, my dad is, it's really nice to have a dad that knows exactly what I'm doing and what's going on. I feel bad for my mother. My mother's had to put up with it for a long time, but you know, she's very supportive as well. And they love that I go out there and do that. And I know that my parents are proud of what I do, and it's awesome.
Clint, you have any closing thoughts, just how you're feeling? I mean, I'm sure you're still like, I'm sure both of you are still kind of decompressing from this trip. It was, you flew out yesterday and we're doing this interview. So, what's next for you?
Well, definitely I'm still decompressing. And I think just letting this sweet feeling sink in for the next week or two, or however long it takes, is going to be the next objective, and just enjoying springtime and flowers and sweet scents. But yeah, this is going to be one that I certainly savor probably for the rest of my life, right? It's probably the most amazing climb I've ever done. And when you think about it, it's an honor to climb something like that and have your name attached to one of the most beautiful mountains in the world.
Yeah.
And in some ways to, you know, share the stage with the greats of the greats of Alaska, the David Roberts and Johnny Watermans and Jack Roberts and Lionel Therese. You know, our name gets to be imprinted on that mountain for the rest of time. And man, I just want to savor that for a while and talk to my family and the people that I really care about, the Charlie Cesaras and Mark Westmans. You know, they come by and give me an attaboy. Man, that means as much as anything to these people that I truly idolized and were so, they shaped my young world as a climber, and they come and give me a congratulations. Man, that's the sweetest feeling of them all, really. Yeah. So for now, just savoring that and just letting summertime roll on.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I can't congratulate you guys enough, man. I'm really just super psyched for both you guys for getting to have that experience. You know, you're both going to end up doing more climbs, but it sounds like it truly was a once in a lifetime experience.
You hope so.
Yeah. I'm done pretending that I could be someone who's ascending all the ladders of this world, but I got someone that I can hold on to, and it's you. Yeah, it's you. I guess I've grown. All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Clint and Jess's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of their alpine wisdom to your next adventure in the mountains. We had musical contributions from my good friend Andy Thulberg. You can check him out online. Don't forget to review the podcast on iTunes, and don't forget to sign up for the mailing list on thefernline.com. And finally, don't forget to check out my tunes on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. Until next time, I'm Evan Phillips, and this is The Fern Line. Just a little while.